from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening. Well, welcome to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. We have kind of a little bit of a bare bones show for you tonight, meaning no guests. It's just the astounding and superior journalist Brody Levesque and I, and we are going to be talking about several of the hot LGBTQ topics of the week, including the perplexing case of Jussie Smollett, which has taken another twist and turn, and a lot of reaction from all sides on that one. We're also going to be talking about the very frustrating, sad, maddening case of a transgender man who was literally being prepped for his surgery when the Catholic hospital in which he was having this done came in and pulled the plug at the very last minute. And obviously it was cruel, it was ridiculous, and we're going to talk about that and the aftermath of that. And then also we're going to talk about other stories, including the Pete Buttigieg. I actually looked that up. That is how you say his last name, Buttigieg. We're probably just going to call him Mayor Pete for the rest of the show. But take the easy way out. So without further ado, I will bring on Brody, and we'll get the conversation started. Good evening, Brody. How are you doing?
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners. I'm fine. I'm annoyed. I think I'm annoyed because it's just been one of those weeks where anything that could possibly go wrong for the LGBTQ community did go wrong. I think the only thing that we had go right this week was the House vote today on the transgender military service situation with the ban. Outside of that, it's been kind of a miserable week for us.
Well, actually, I have learned never to say everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong, because as soon as I say that, then something else comes up that goes even further wrong. So you can always dig down.
I guess we could probably do that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so you brought it up first about the House vote, about the trying to nullify the transgender ban, transgender in the military ban. Brody, realistically, how far is this going to go? Is it even going to be voted on in the Senate?
The truth of the matter is it's a non-starter. The House vote to rebuke Trump's ban is a non-binding resolution, and the vote was 238-185 after about roughly an hour of debate on the floor. The usual suspects on the Republican side, including Missouri Congressman Vicky Hartzler, who's been very much on the record as being opposed to trans people in general, made a whole bunch of noise. But what this basically boils down to is it's not going to really do anything. It's a resolution that basically calls out the hypocrisy, and it calls out the discriminatory practice that's about to get put into place by the Trump administration. That's about all it really does. As far as the Senate goes, I mean, this resolution doesn't have the force of standard resolution. So, I mean, more or less what this does is it just, you know, tuts the president and Vice President Mike Pence for, you know, being discriminatory bigots when it comes down to the trans community. That's all it really does.
Isn't it kind of actually a little bit appalling when you look at this vote, however? I believe only 5 Republicans voted with the Democrats on it.
That's true.
And yeah. I would have thought there would have been more in the Republican contingency that would have stood up and said no. and especially since this wasn't even going to go anywhere, that would have gone on record to be opposed to the ban. I mean, isn't there kind of another sort of ugly underbelly to this as well?
Well, there is. It goes really to the heart of what we've been reporting on since the initial accessions policy debacle got started now, 2 years ago, in actually about this time in 2017. The effort has been spearheaded by the Christian supremacists in not only just the Trump administration, but in the Pentagon. The Secretary of the Air Force, Heather Wilson, the former Secretary of the Air Force, made it abundantly clear that she was anti-trans. Yeah, the irony here was is that the military personnel, including the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, Commandant of the Marine Corps, Army Chief of Staff, Chief of Naval Operations, everybody was on the record as they didn't have a problem with any of this. You know, the whole thing the military wanted was if you're able to serve, then you can serve. That was it.
Right.
This was all driven politically. And again, it was sour grapes that it really kicked off because Vicki Hartzler, the aforementioned, you know, Congress bigot from Missouri, wasn't able to get her way on an amendment that had to do with the original accessions policy. And she and her little cobble of Freedom Caucus and a few other anti-trans people, including Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, went whining to Vice President Pence, who in turn whined to Donald Trump, and Trump being the wonderfully effective moron he is and the ultimate in ass-kisser, decided to keep his Republican and evangelical base happy, and that's how this whole thing got started. You know, the argument that they've used, in fact, all of the arguments they've used throughout this entire process are nonsensical. They're pseudoscience. They're wrong. We've had people such as Lieutenant Commander Blake Dunham on the show. I know Staff Sergeant Logan Ireland, met him a couple times. If they can wear the uniform of the United States, they should be able to, you know, wear the uniform of the United States. But the problem is that this is all rooted in the, quite frankly, pseudoscience and the stupidity and the Christian supremacy and the bigotry. The trans population, Rob, is just the latest in a long, long series and string of boogeymen that the Christian right has to have in order to keep themselves in power and have their pockets lined so that they can afford to fly around their private jets. You know, that's all it amounts to.
Totally understood. I understand where the ban came from and who pushed it and all of that. But to your point, it came out of the Freedom Caucus, which even in the Republican caucus is kind of a pain in their side. It just surprises me that there weren't more solid veteran-leaning military minds in the Republican caucus to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. And, you know, to cross the party line, why this ended up being such a party line vote is the part that I'm surprised at.
I'm not. I mean, I've been observing, you know, the politics of the Republican Party since 1994 when they literally, with Newt Gingrich and the Contract for America, went around the bend. They've been getting progressively worse. I mean, if you'll remember 2 or 3 summers ago, there was a shooting in Virginia, and several congressmen got hit, including Representative Scalise of Louisiana, and these people are still married to the NRA. It's the normalcy of the cynicism of the Republican politics that most people, you know, like you, aren't getting, and reporters like me are just shaking our head. They're not stepping back, and they're gone. I mean, you look at the Republican Party today, and it's a hot mess. And what's worse is since the Orange Menace was elected, it sits behind the Resolute desk in the Oval, it's just gotten progressively worse. So I'm not surprised by this, and then I'm not surprised by anyone not crossing over. It's, you know, they rely on these evangelicals and they rely on these Christian supremacists to keep the coffers in their campaign war chests full. And they don't dare, you know, do anything that would be remotely, you know, construed as helpful to trans or lesbian or gay or whatever the case may be. They just rot. They won't do it. So I'm not surprised.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it is what it is, you know.
It is. And I want to pivot a little bit, even though this isn't per se an LGBT issue, but it is probably the biggest one in the room right now. And speaking of Republican, being cynical around Republicans, the Mueller report came out. And
yes.
I mean, this is a ridiculous travesty. I'm hearing that the actual report is 300 pages. The Attorney General's summation was 4, which is insane. Of course, the spin after this, trying to claim vindication, et cetera, is just so patently absurd and such an insult to anybody's intelligence who's been observing this even slightly. What is coming next? It's become a free for all.
Politically, it has become a free for all. A lot of people today latched on to the fact once the New York Times disclosed what they'd learned, that there was in fact 300 pages in the report. And again, personally, I don't think it's probably going to be that much longer before at least major sections of that thing get leaked. But you know what it basically comes down to is there's two salient facts to this, and that was the current Attorney General essentially auditioned for his job with a memorandum he wrote on presidential powers long before the mess got started. And this was even before Sessions recused himself. He's taken the report by the special counsel. He's taken the work product of Director Mueller and his crew. He's made it where he's tried to inoculate the presidency because he believes that that's the way it should be. Unfortunately, legally, he's not obligated to release that report, and that includes to Capitol Hill. His letter to Congress on Sunday is all that the law requires. So if he wanted to play hardball with the Hill, he could because he's on solid ground. Politically, it would be disastrous if he was to try that. Now, whether or not we're going to see the actual support, and unlike the Ken Starr debacle back during the Clinton administration now almost 20 years ago, I don't think we're probably going to see it showing up in the Washington Post like the way the Starr report did. But I would hope that the Attorney General is astute enough to understand that, you know, Congress is not going to sit back and let this one go. This is a bipartisan thing. They're doing it for their own agendas. The Republicans want to prove that there was no collusion and that Trump didn't obstruct justice. That's why they want the report released. The Democrats want it released because it'll prove that there was obstruction of justice and there was at least collusion within certain elements of the campaign. The central question that wasn't answered and will not be answered until we get some sort of indication what the special counsel has in the report is the ages-old Nixonian question of, what did the president know, and when did the president know it? That's kind of where we're at with that. And there's not an answer to that unless we get that. I read the Attorney General's letter very carefully, all 4 pages of it, and we kind of did an autopsy, if you will, of it, and a forensic study, however you want to put that. He was careful. He was very careful in his wording to protect the president in terms of culpability for collusion. I noticed, however, he didn't touch what Director Mueller said in terms of exoneration, and that was key and critical. Now, some things that most people in the heat of battle, in the heat of the moment, aren't understanding. The special counsel actually extended the term of his grand jury into September. Now, he's done. That's it. He's finished. But that grand jury's still there. So the investigation is still going on. He took major sections outside of the people already indicted, convicted, and sentenced, and he has assigned those out to either the United States attorneys and grand juries for the District of Columbia and the Circuit Court of Appeals, and also for the Southern District of New York U.S. attorneys, as well as the state of New York's Attorney General's office. So this is not over by a long shot. Trump can sit there and say, well, you know, no collusion and exoneration and this and that and the other thing. But we've seen some of the Director Mueller's work product, and I think at the end of the day, you know, are we going to see Trump leave office before 12:01 p.m. on January 20th, 2021? No, probably not. Do I think he's going to get reelected? I doubt that. There was a poll that was done today by Quinnipiac University, a respected polling outfit, that showed that 53% of the American electorate disapprove of him. It's going to be a close, it'll be a close call, but he's not going to get reelected. Now, does that mean that at 12:01 p.m. on January 20, 2021, he's going to get frog walked, perp walked to a waiting Suburban and whisked away to Con Air back to New York? I don't know. But I do think there's a very strong possibility that he's probably going to find himself in legal hot water. And I'll tell you, I am hands down absolutely certain that Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump Jr., possibly even their brother Eric, the CFO of the Trump Organization, and a few other people, are probably going to find themselves getting indicted in New York under the RICO statutes. I keep reminding people, Rob, if you look at the Trump Organization, for all intents and purposes, it's New York's sixth crime family. You know, you get the five original mob families that
had
the Trump.
Yeah. And are they would all be potential beneficiaries of presidential pardons, though, correct?
Well, here's the thing, and this is the fun part, okay? Trump's pardon powers only extend to federal. That's it.
That's what I was wondering.
So if,
if
the state attorney general in New York decides to go after them under New York law, their goose is cooked. Trump himself can't even be pardoned from that. So, you know, everybody's who's in the progressive liberal Democratic Party, you know, the dream there is to see him in an orange jumpsuit and at Sing Sing. That could happen, theoretically, but I don't know whether or not it will. Because keep in mind, too, there's something that people need to understand. At the end of the day, this guy's got lots and lots and lots and lots of money. People who have lots and lots and lots of money tend to hire lots of high-priced lawyers who drag these things on forever. You know, Trump may end up, you know, expiring before he gets convicted of anything.
Right.
Man, he's
right,
70-something, so keep that in mind, you know.
Well, yeah, actually, his kids are the ones that I was thinking of more than him being susceptible to it.
Yeah, probably.
But
more so than him.
Yeah, but let's go to somebody else's legal troubles, to the one that I mentioned at the top of the show. Jussie Smollett, I mean, this has been bizarre. I mean, it's always been bizarre from beginning to end. And the thing that is sort of part of the aftermath is not just the discussion and the ongoing discussion of whether he was truly innocent or not, but who is saying what about this? There is definitely people coming from both sides of the aisle having commentary. One of the a certain publication which you and I both were associated with in the past came out with an article that was sort of inflammatory, claiming only white, straight people were proclaiming Jussie Smollett guilty, and, you know, which was not actually true and sort of race baiting. But anyway, what is going on with that?
I think what happened, you know, and we need to put this in context for the listenership. He forfeited $10,000 from his bond. He's required to do, I think, 2 or 3 days community service. The record was sealed at the request of the Cook County attorney, and then the legal team asked that the arrest itself get expunged. Now, I need to make this distinction because a lot of listeners probably are not aware of this. An expungement, depending upon how it's applied, could be either the arrest record itself or the conviction or the null process. In other words, if they don't prosecute. A record seal means that that will stay intact. Here's the thing. The expungement that was requested will back the arrest out of the system. And there's a good reason for this, a very practical reason for this. If you don't expunge all of that, let's say he travels to Bangladesh and he gets to customs and immigration in Bangladesh and they screen his passport. Okay. Guess what will pop up on the screen? The felony arrests. Now, that country may have a policy of deciding that they don't want anybody like that in the country and they'll say, no, go away. On top of the fact, right, there's also the stigma of the arrest. Okay. So there's practical reasons for expunging it. The sealing of the record, I think that the Cook County State's Attorney probably did that more than anything else just to protect her office. She got a lot of flack for this. She actually had recused herself from this mess. People are screaming about, see, this proves that the Chicago police are racist and he didn't do it and this, that, and the other thing. The preponderance of evidence that was leaked by credible sources tells me that he did it. Okay. And the reason he's not getting charged is directly related to the fact that people like the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, Eddie T. Johnson, okay, made some critical missteps when they went public with it, and they literally had the case tried in the court of public opinion and the media. There are people within the legal structure in Illinois that probably took one look at that and went, this isn't going to work. You know, Rob, it's often a tactic for a defense counsel to ask for a trial to be moved someplace else because they're afraid that they're not going to get a jury that'll fairly hear the trial. Now, every once in a rare while, that happens for a prosecutor. This would have been the case. In the Smollett situation, there was so much that got leaked into the media, and I'm going to give hats off to the Chicago Tribune, CBS3 in Chicago, and ABC7 in Chicago for doing an amazing job of covering the story, and they literally sourced everything out. And sadly and unfortunately, by sourcing everything out, yeah, Smollett was literally, you know, charged, sentenced, and fried in the court of public opinion. And quite frankly, American jurisprudence is not based on that. And I, at the end of the day, I think the prosecutor didn't have a choice. She knew she had a case she wasn't going to win. She also had a case that had already expended a lot of taxpayer money from the investigation itself. She had a grand jury. Now, the thing about the grand jury, and I always point this out to people, a grand jury basically, and it's the old joke, can indict a ham sandwich. A grand jury is a prosecutorial tool that is used by prosecutors. It's to determine beyond reasonable doubt, or if a grand jury thinks that there's enough there, okay, to level charges. It's not the same as a jury in a jury trial. A lot of people get those two confused. A grand jury is different. Now, I'm not going to say that a grand jury is the rubber stamp of prosecutorial team's work. It's not. A prosecutorial team, you know, they're set up for it a different way. But the grand jury weighs the evidence, and if they think there's enough there, then they're going to go ahead and do that. And in this case, with Smollett, the reason for 16 felony counts is also a prosecutor's tactic. You know, he lied to a uniformed police officer, that's 8 counts. Then he turned around and he lied to a detective, that's another 8 counts. And it's a pile-on. And the reason prosecutors do that is that they're hoping that the defense team will negotiate out a plea bargain. They don't have to take it to trial, which is hideously expensive and time-consuming, and they can move on to the next issue. And that's another tool for a grand jury, because a grand jury will say, sure, you know, let's throw as many charges and see what sticks. And then it's up to the defense team to sort through all that. Okay. Now, in Smollett's case, the problem, I think, throughout this entire story episode, and I'm part of the media, I think it got blown out of proportion because of the notoriety of who he is. And the real damage at the end of the day isn't to Jussie Smollett. It certainly isn't to the Chicago Police Department. It's not even to the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. The real damage here is the district attorneys all over the United States are going to take a look at the Smollett case and go, do we really want to go into that mess? So that means if their
right.
police departments or their sheriff's departments or their investigators bring them, you know, what could be potential hate crime cases, you know, they're going to err on the side of caution and go, you know what, we're not going to go there with this. And that's really becoming a big problem because what this essentially does is it literally ruins the credibility for legitimate victims. Do I believe that Smollett is a legitimate victim? No, not at all. Okay. I don't know what his reasons were for doing it. I'm not going to speculate. Okay. But from the sources and from my reporters and the other people and my colleagues, you know, from the information that sadly and unfortunately was leaked, along with information that we got before the court sealed the case file, yeah, he pulled a hoax. I don't know why he did it. Quite
yeah.
frankly, at this point, I don't care. All I care about is
right.
the fact that this is going to hurt.
Yeah, and the people that are coming back, they're not really defending Jussie Smollett. I mean, some are saying, kind of myopic and saying, oh, he was declared innocent and leave him alone, which I can't see anybody who looks at the case can actually summarize that, because that isn't what it seems to be there. But the real criticism that is coming back is that so much resource on the upfront and the aftermath on this
mm-hmm.
case is being spent. There's outrage by the police department and the mayor's
mm-hmm.
office and everything else, when there's so many other cases that justice has not been done, where the victims are African-American, where they were police shootings, where there were different cases and crickets from the same people that are now outraged and, you know, having basically a big hissy fit. And I guess the point of the people that are feeling the offense of this is not that, you know, Jussie Smollett is completely innocent, but it's like, why he's not going to go do this again, you know, leave it alone and put your resources to things that truly are continuing to happen and horrifying.
Well, the problem that you run into is that this is the core issue with the American judicial system, and that is that if you have money, you get justice. If you don't, you're screwed, and it's a reality.
Exactly.
You know, Smollett is, you know, from my take, you know, I watched the interview with, you know, my colleague Robin at ABC News, Good Morning America. I've watched some of his other interviews, and he strikes me as your typical, you know, narcissistic, self-centered, self-important celebrity type, you know, and it has nothing at all to do with sexual orientation, race, or anything like that. I'm talking as a human being, okay? Basically, he's a class A asshole. You know, it doesn't matter if, you know, he's put up a front of, you know, all these things he's done for gay rights and this and that. And I just, I have to be cynical because I have to look at a larger picture. And I have to question, well, how much of that was done because he wanted the pat on the back, the medal, the attaboy, the award from GLAD or HRC or NAACP or whatever. Yeah, I'm being very cynical here because he plays everything off of his celebrity. That was one thing that Superintendent Johnson probably got right, although saying it in that press conference in a public forum, quite frankly, was wrong. It could have waited until after the fact. But that resource waste by the Chicago police, you know, into this was only because he was a celebrity. You know, quite frankly, at the end of the day, if he'd been just your average gay black guy that happened to, you know, a cop would have come, made a report, and that would have been the end of it. And guaranteed, probably.
Well, I think Yeah, and I think that's part of the frustration of people that are reacting to the outrage, is that many people have made those kind of reports in Chicago and been ignored.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing, too, with Smollett is, you know, and I hear what you're saying about celebrity and all that, but the thing was, from day one, what this played out to be immediately was as a hate crime, and people did react very deeply and emotionally to what they perceived and believed happened to him. I mean, Ellen Page mm-hmm. was in tears on late night TV, you know, it was like with a very uh-huh. real and heartfelt reaction. And Robin Roberts' interview was not trying to validate the case at all. It was in pure sympathy of, you know, that these hate crimes occur. And that is, part of the frustration is, to your point about credibility of future hate crimes. I want to move on, though, because we've got other things we want to talk about. This case of a transgender man. And to be honest with you, this case, and I'll let you tell the details of it, the thing that bothers me most about this case is the emotional distress, not just of an institution exercising its quote-unquote religious freedom, but the timing of it, doing it at the most cruel possible moment to the individual involved. So, Brody, briefly tell us what happened there and what's transpiring.
Certainly. 27-year-old Eureka resident, and that's Eureka, California, obviously, Oliver Knight was lying on a gurney in a pre-surgical holding area, and this was in August of 2017, and he had an IV dripped up, and he was waiting for the general anesthetic to be administered, so the IV drip was already running. All the rest of the prep had been done. He was going to have a hysterectomy procedure, which is fairly, you know, complicated, but in this particular hospital, it was fairly routine. As a matter of fact, it's very routine for this particular hospital. And then his surgeon came in, literally at the point that the anesthesiologist should have been in to do a plot, you know, to go ahead and administer the anesthetic, and said, "Your surgery's been canceled." And the reason was because the hospital administrators killed it after one of the religious overseers, in this case a Monsignor of the Catholic Church, because it's a Catholic hospital, found out about it, found out that he was a trans male, and that was incompatible with Catholic teachings. You're a Catholic hospital and you won't do it. Oliver has since launched a lawsuit. In fact, that was filed March 21st in Humboldt County in state court, Superior Court, by the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. And ironically, the attorney, Elizabeth Gill, the hospital, St. Joseph, is part of the Providence St. Joseph Health Network. And this is a national Catholic not-for-profit hospital system. It's got about roughly 51 hospitals with about 25,000 physicians. And in California alone, it operates 18 hospitals. Now, the thing about what they did, though, was that California's got a law in the book called the UNRU Act, the Civil Rights Act, and the public accommodations laws fall within that. And Knight being denied that health care, especially surgery, was based on the hospital's religious views, actually directly conflicts with the accommodation laws under the UNRU. Or I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's named after a California lawmaker under the act, okay? And when I talked to Elizabeth, she pointed out that particular hospital regularly does hysterectomies for cisgender people, okay? In fact, the physician and surgeon that was getting ready to do Knight surgery regularly perform that procedure. So it became relatively obvious that the only reason the surgical procedure didn't go forward was discriminatory based on the fact that Oliver is a trans man. the core issue revolves around opposition to trans rights, which has come down to the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops. And then in turn goes to all of the hospitals and things that are run by the Catholic Church. And in order to make it kind of, it's a little bit hard to understand, but the hospitals have administrators who are, if you will, are civilians, but they answer to a Catholic priest, a Monsignor, or a bishop. In other words, that religious person can override the administrator. And that's what happened here, is that's exactly what happened. Now, Oliver wrote, and I'm going to read this so our listeners get an understanding of how bad this was. He wrote a blog post for the ACLU, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read one statement that's kind of pertinent. On August 30, I arrived at the hospital. They checked me in. They did the surgery prep, which was extremely uncomfortable and triggering. I was given a pink gown. I asked the nurse if I could have a blue gown, and she said, well, I was having female surgery, so I should wear pink. I felt like a child all over again, sitting uncomfortably in a pink dress. I forced myself to do it because I've been waiting so long for this. And he talks about what happened. It seems that the Catholic bishops didn't approve of my surgery. Then Oliver continues with this. I had an anxiety attack and thought about all the pre-op and mental preparedness I had just gone through in order to get there. I freaked out and I started crying. Then I was given medication to calm down. 15 minutes after that, hospital staff asked me to leave. I still had booties on as a nurse led me outside. I felt humiliated and queasy as I sat on the curb waiting for my roommate to pick me up. Now, he's since had the surgery. It was done by another healthcare provider. But right. You can imagine how traumatic that whole thing was.
No, it's horrible the way he was treated. It's unconscionable. It's humiliating. Just every bit of that is mortifying. I do have a question for you, Brody. Does this establishment in this hospital, do they perform abortions?
No.
So they're upfront about their moral weigh-in on the surgeries that are performed in their establishment.
Uh-huh. Okay. But the thing and I see where you're going with this, but it should be pointed out, okay, that this is what is known as gender-affirming surgery. And technically, termination of a fetus is at a different ballgame. You know, gender-affirming surgery, and this is a routine medical procedure. This hospital and, every other in the St. Joseph's Network does it all the time, okay? You know, I asked Elizabeth, I said, especially since we're talking California, I asked her if she found Knight's case troubling, especially since it did occur in California, and her answer was one word, very. You know, the state of California, the one place where you would not expect that to happen, and yet, here it happened in California, which is, again, why they're suing. I think it's unfortunate, and it speaks to the heart of, the overarching issue, and that is that the Americans still have too much of a problem with the separation of church and state, and that, fundamentalist Christians and Christian supremacists, and I'll include the Catholics in that, that categorization and characterization, still think that they've got a right, to force their religious beliefs on anybody because they, quote unquote, have their religious freedoms. The problem that you get with that, though, and this has been again and again, and this is kind of the basis for this suit, is that if you're going to serve the public and you're going to open your doors to the public, there's got to be certain common sense restrictions on that. And California's got enough laws on the books, okay, that should be the case. And, of course, as you know now, that there is significant pushback on that because we're seeing that with all these religious freedom laws that are being passed left and right. It's, I think, really an attempt by the Catholic Church and the Christian supremacists to try, they couldn't criminalize us, so now the next thing is let's try and legislate them out of existence. Good luck with that.
Right. No, and I hear you, and there, you know, there are questions of, you know, what can be performed and what is discrimination against a gender because they're performed for one gender, you know, or for certain individuals, and the exact same operation is being performed and, you know, uh-huh. or not performed for another individual, you know, and the how they navigate that from a legal and equitable standpoint. I just see there's two levels to this that, you know, and I'm not even speaking legally, I'm speaking more emotionally and causing somebody humiliation and distress. I mean, if somebody was in the hospital lined up for an abortion and then they did this to that woman at that point, I think it would have been a similar thing where, you know, it's like, this is not acceptable that you lead people on and treat them this way through a process and then pull the rug out. That's just, there's a innate cruelty to that behavior, you know, apart from, mm-hmm. you know, everything that the ACLU would go after there. Since we're shifting around though, I want to jump to Mayor Pete, gay mayor from Indiana, who is kind of surprising a lot of people because he is pulling up third in the Iowa caucuses right behind mm-hmm. Bernie and Biden, not necessarily in that order. He is coming out with a very, you know, broad American population message, trying to appeal to everybody. He's not trying to leverage himself as the gay candidate, although he is certainly a significant presence as one. Here's what I saw interesting going on this week, and mm-hmm. Brody, let me know, you know, your stand on it. But in that vein, he was talking and making remarks about Chick-fil-A, who
yes.
has come under scrutiny recently, and it's found that they, in fact, have continued part of their donation process of giving to anti-gay organizations. And so certainly prime candidates for an ongoing boycott and disgust and people wanting to avoid their food for that reason. Well, Mayor Pete was taking kind of the high road. And he definitely did not commend them or look away from it, but simply was trying to outreach, you know, again, across the aisle and say, let's have a conversation. And that has led to its own set of backlash, again, from the publication you and I were once associated with, where it was, you know, pearls clutching, you know, palm to the forehead, you know, how dare he? And it's, I mean, I'm reading this and I'm going, oh my God, this is a trailblazer, somebody who is going where we have never gone before, and you're going to worry about this. Do we get it? Do we understand what it's going to take for people to make landmark strides for the entire American public?
I have said this before. I've said it on the air. I said it to you in private. You know, the biggest problem with the gay movement is the gay movement. Yeah, it's worse than trying to herd cats in a parade. There's a balkanization, and I remind people that the gay community, you know, is not homogenous at all whatsoever. And you have to look at Mayor Pete. Lieutenant in the U.S. Navy Reserve. He was deployed to Afghanistan. He's a counterterrorism expert. He's earned a Joint Service Commendation Medal. He's a Harvard grad. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's a concert pianist. He speaks seven languages, and he also writes in seven languages, including Norwegian. Okay. Of course, I have to compare that to our current president, who's not read any books and is fluent barely even in English.
Our current president has to be thrilled that he speaks Norwegian, though, because that is one of the acceptable immigration countries. Yeah, so anyway, go ahead. Too. I didn't I just had to keep it in.
It's when you're looking at the mayor, and I've spoken to him, and it was actually in his capacity of mayor of South Bend, Indiana, on a completely non-related subject, and this was like a year or so ago. He reminds me a lot of then-Governor Jimmy Carter, who later became President Carter. You see a lot of the same progressive ideals and a lot of the same, you know, sense of morality. The mayor is a gay Christian. The mayor looks at things a certain way. He's mayor of a city that, you know, has had a lot of issues, and he's been kind of a calming force, if you will. On top of the fact that he's very politically astute. Now, one of the things that is upsetting, I think, to the pearl clutchers, including the former publication we used to work for, is that he's not one of the corporate elitists and he's not one of the power structure. And at the end of the day, as a political reporter, I kind of find it refreshing that he's not. You know, when I look at Senator Sanders, who's 79 years old, who's all over the board with whatever it is he's doing. When I look at, you know, Vice President Joe Biden, also in his 70s, had a really good career, done wonders for all sorts of things. I look at Elizabeth Warren, you know, another career politician with her track record in the Democratic Party. You know, the list goes on and on and on. I also look at what happened 60 years ago when Jack Kennedy was elected president on a movement of, you know, the torch has been passed. And I think this is really a problem for the Democratic Party and for the progressives. You know, Mayor Pete's sexuality and sexual orientation, I don't think factors in so much as the fact that, you know, this is another young, smart, bright politician who doesn't like to kowtow to the corporate elitists and the coastal elitists, and that bothers them. You know, Beto O'Rourke, congressman from a former congressman from El Paso, Senator Kamala Harris of California, Cory Booker of New Jersey. You look at the rest of the Democratic field, you suddenly realize that there is literally the Grand Canyon of difference politically in there. I think that watching him come up to third in the caucus is kind of critically important because there's a seismic shift now with the Democratic voters and the base in particular, particularly with independents who could vote Democratic, the ones that stayed home in 2016. And what it's really going to count is whether or not, you know, the hard scrabble red states that are in the battleground areas will listen to it. Well, you know, this guy's from Indiana. He's a mayor of a Rust Belt city. You know, he should do okay in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, next door in Ohio. How's he going to play in California? They're probably going to think he's Jerry Brown White. I mean, he's going to have problems in the South. And the main problem he's going to have in the South is because, you know, quite frankly, not to put too fine a point on it, but they're all a bunch of xenophobic homophobes and racists down there. All they're going to see is gay and a pride flag. You know, they're not going to pay any attention to the fact that this guy really is brilliant, smart, whip smart, you know, and really is a differentiated version of probably a mixture of President Obama and President Carter, you know. And it's unfortunate. This is a guy that's worn the uniform of the country. He served with distinction and honor. This is a guy who's married. He's stable. This is a guy who's doing a hell of a job as mayor of South Bend. And more importantly than anything else, if he gets elected, when he gets out of office, he'll still be 46. He could come back and run for a Senate seat from Indiana or even be governor of Indiana. Yeah. At the end of the day, you've got something that, you know, the Americans need. But the one thing I've learned about your country over the years is you all don't learn until you get a bloody nose. And that's unfortunate. And now you've got your bloody nose. How do I know? Because it's sitting in the Oval Office. You've got someone who has later literally laid siege to your government and, for all intents and purposes, screwed the pooch. On top of the fact, he's lowered the standard of your country in the world's eyes. You get someone like the mayor, okay, you have a chance at righting the ship and turning things around. Now, there's going to be people that are going to yell, no foreign, you know, policy expertise, no government expertise past being the mayor of a medium-sized American city. No this. And, of course, the gay elephant in the room for all the Christian crazies, the Catholics, and the people that, you know, believe their book of fairy tales is, you know, how the American government's supposed to be run. So there are going to be some, you know, insurmountable problems there. But the biggest problem, Rob, is not going to come from the actual Republicans in the opposition. The biggest problem is going to come from the progressives and the Democrats themselves.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Although his appeal right now, from the reports I've read, is, and he actually could be a big problem for Bernie because he is being seen as the young Bernie. So people who like Bernie, but, you know, want, you know, concerned about the age thing, he's kind of fitting the bill. So he could split that vote, which would mean both of them would fail.
You're looking at it this way. Yeah. Well, I was just going to make a note on. I was just going to follow up on what you said.
No, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead, because I was just going to change the subject. So go ahead.
Yeah, Vice President Biden's going to hop in the race probably in the next few weeks. That's going to change the entire Democratic ticket front anyway. An ideal ticket might actually end up with Biden and, you know, Mayor Pete, or Biden and Kamala Harris, or some mixture of the two. And that would give the Democrats the opportunity to take the White House back and probably maybe even narrow the distance in the Senate. I honestly don't think they'll get the Senate back. The House they should be able to retain. But I think that Mayor Pete represents real change across the board. The question is whether or not the powers to be, and these are the ones that write the checks in the Democratic Party, the DCCC, and everything else, are going to pay attention to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned Biden, because that was where I was going to pivot a little bit, because Joe Biden created some stir within the LGBT community recently by just declaring that Mike Pence was a decent guy, which is very characteristic of him, too, because he has a history of reaching across the aisle, you know, trying to reach people in their general character, you know, in terms of their own personal sense of integrity, whether we agree with it or even find it actually disgusting. But, you know, there's people who are wrongheaded because their belief system is in our opinion, screwed up. And then there are people like Trump that just don't seem to have morals at all.
I think he was just,
you know, again, trying to be the candidate for all without giving up his principles. And it blows my mind that people can't see the bigger picture of somebody who really blew politics open for marriage equality and a lot of LGBTQ rights to suddenly worry because he was being polite. I mean, it just seems like, have we lost all perspective?
At the risk of repeating myself, the problem with the gay movement is the gay movement.
Right.
You have what I call, you know, the radical puritanical Puritans that, you know, this is the way they want it. I actually mixed it up with one of those the other day on Twitter, and I finally said, you know, that's fine. It's your opinion. And that person fired back with, well, you're just opinion, blah, blah, blah. And I finally got annoyed. And I said, no, this is where you're wrong. It's not just my opinion. It's the fact that it's my expert opinion. It comes from 40 years of being a political reporter, covering your country's politics, interviewing these people, talking to these people, getting to know these people. You know, you can sit there on your keyboard at your office or in your mom's basement and hack away as a social justice warrior and a troll. And the reality check is that, you know, I've talked to these people, I've dealt with them, I've been there, done that. So, yeah, guess what? If it comes down, you know, to a genitalia measuring contest, mine is bigger than yours. And I think probably the reason I've gotten, well, and people say, Brody, you know, that's not necessary. And I went, well, you know, it probably shouldn't be necessary. But the toxicity has gotten so bad, and Trump has not made it any easier for those of us in my profession, that I've gotten to the point where I just don't, you know, put up with it anymore. You know, I'm
right.
Sorry.
Well,
you know, I've been there, done that. And when it comes down to Joe Biden, Don't get me wrong. I have the world of respect for the vice president and Dr. Biden. Okay. I think he's amazing. I absolutely hands off to everything that he did during the Obama administration, what he did during his career as a United States Senator. Okay. But like Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders, you know, they need to sit this one out. You know, it's a Jack Kennedy thing. The torch has been passed, and if it hasn't been passed, it damn well needs to be.
Yeah. Well, I was going to make a joke that we only have 4 inches, I mean 4 minutes left here. So you did have one more story that you wanted to get in about funds for, I think it's Medicare, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, the whole thing that is going on with the conversion therapy thing, there's a the co-chair of the House Congressional Democratic LGBT Caucus, Sean Patrick Maloney, has introduced a bill today, as a matter of fact. And basically, this is a prohibition of Medicaid funding for the Conversion Therapy Act. So far, he's got about 63 co-sponsors. The congressman said this: conversion practices are discredited, harmful, and not therapy. Fundamentally, conversion tactics are based on the idea that a person's gender identity or sexual orientation are diseases to be cured. They have no legitimate medical application and should not be used anywhere. Until we can just ban conversion therapy altogether, we must ensure taxpayer dollars aren't funding a fraudulent practice that has been roundly discredited by the medical community. And that's exactly what my bill would do. Now, this should get through the House. I'm kind of hoping that it'll get through the Senate. If it does, it goes to the president for signature, and I will guarantee you that Pence will make sure that Trump kills it. Okay? And that's sad, and it's unfortunate, because, you know, we've gotten to the point in the 21st century where we really need to, you know, go back to the idea that your country's founders had, and that is a direct separation on a wall between church and state. And, you know, at the end of the day, the Christian crazies and the Catholics need to stay out of people's bedrooms, period.
Yeah, I think some of this, though, is being done to lift the covers up on whose stand is what, so it can be used in the election. Because some of these, I think, are ones that are ill-fated in terms of actually going through, but it seems like the votes are being done so that it can paint Republicans who are in more moderate positionings. And these are not, you know, a lot of these are a plurality of the American people are for them or stand on our side. And I think that's what some of the method to this is going to be. So, Brody, we are out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank you so much for your learned and, as always, important conversation on all these topics. We will be back again next week. I also want our listeners to be aware of my other show on KSCO, www.ksco.com. That is with Vashti Eldon, who has his own set of great opinions. You want to hear that. And that is Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. That's Robin Bash on www.ksco.com. For Brody and myself, again, we will be back here next week, same time on Blog Talk Radio. Also, look at all our past podcasts, which you can listen to on www.blogtalk.com/ratedLGBTradio. With that, we will bid you good night and Godspeed, and we will talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.